You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Come, Christmas. Come, most needed of seasons. Come with the reminder that love does not need perfection and does not depend on perfection, but on willingness to risk genuine connection. Come, Christmas, into the cluttered and unready manger of our hearts, that newborn life may stir in us and give mortal flesh to airy hope. For healing for our world. Come, Christmas. Come, love. Come, hope. Be born in our unready hearts. Ah, December at last. Finally, we've arrived at that time of year when peace on earth settles on us all like a warm doona. Simple visions like visions of sugar plums dance in the heads of our children. And families become, as if by magic, not merely functional, but genuinely face-achingly gleeful to get together. There seems to be oceans of time, and the pace of life is as leisurely as a long lunch. And all of the familiar cultural narratives of the season are not trite or crass or an exercise in mass self-delusion. Best of all, in a culture like ours, Christmas, December, is a time when everybody gets to be Christian, whether they are or not. You get to be Christian, and you get to be Christian, and you get to, everybody gets to be Christian. It's not just the lapsed who skulk back into churches this one time of year in a search of childhood memories of carols, organ pipes, and an annual whiff of candle wax and frankincense and myrrh. Everybody gets to be in the Jesus fan club because everywhere we are reminded that this month marks an event in human history whose uniqueness and significance is eternal and universal, and everyone, of course, recognizes, right? One particular obscure birth, a birth which is historically doubtful, lavishly mythologized, and appropriated by church and state and commerce for their own purposes. The whole world, it seems, mobilizes toward and then abruptly stops for the day that rightly or wrongly marks this one obscure birth. Even people with no religion, or who are anti-religion, or who are in wildly different religions, are no match for the cultural tsunami of Christmas sweeping all before it. There is no escape, not even for us. Especially not for us, because, I remind you, we display to the world without a shred of irony or explanation those massive high art images of the adult version of the same baby. The miracle there is that he's the only Anglo-Saxon who was ever born to Middle Eastern parents. Look at him. Look at him. He's like a soulful Scandinavian hipster playing dress up with a thing for livestock. Why, though? Why, though? Why should so much attention, energy, resources, and cultural narrative for 2,000 years be mobilized by the birth of that one Palestinian Jewish baby? I mean, it's disproportionate, to say the least. It's also, and so very singular, that the annual sweet baby Jesus worship should explain itself, at least to those who, so we say, have seen through the dogmas of the Christian cultural domination. Why are we essentially closed Christmas Eve? A favored time for retelling the old tale of a Middle Eastern couple seeking refuge. Why don't we put up a nativity display if we're ready to advertise Jesus? Think about it. Even last week's nativity play was a play about putting on a nativity play. We distance ourselves from the story, and yet we are still somehow enthralled to it. Because Unitarian Christology, such as it is that Jesus was not divine, conceived without coitus, but fully, squelchily, messily human, just like us. But the story of the Nativity seems to echo nevertheless, even for us. Come December, we all become as children again, at least a little, or are encouraged to. So for us, rather than to indulge in the Christmas mythology, and rather than trying to ignore the fact that it's going on all around us, we might instead make a virtue of the necessity of being caught up in a Christian culture and inquire what it might mean for us as Unitarians. To ask why, for two millennia, the image of this newborn child has been so compelling of so much human energy and attention. Why the infant Jesus is such a far better marketing tool than the adult version. Remember, the adult version actually had things to say. Is there something about the human infant that gives us an intimation, a hint of the sacred that lies beyond all stories and all images? Or gives us an insight into something basic about our human nature? Well, there is a particular view about infancy which might give us a clue as to why the story endures. It was given very famous expression in a poem by William Wordsworth with the ponderous title Ode, Intimations of Immortality from Recollections of Early Childhood by William Wordsworth. It's read by Bev Barry.
There was a time when meadow, grove, and stream, the earth and every common sight, to me did seem apparelled in celestial light. The glory and the freshness of a dream, it is not now as it hath been of yore. Turn where'er so I may, by night or day, the things which I have seen, I now can see no more. The rainbow comes and goes, and lovely as the rose, the moon doth with delight look round her when the heavens are bare. Waters on a starry night are beautiful and fair. The sunshine is a glorious birth. But yet I know, where'er I go, that there hath passed away a glory from the earth. Whither is fled the visionary gleam? Where is it now, the glory and the dream? Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath had elsewhere its setting. And cometh from afar, not an entire forgetfulness, and not an utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, who is our home. Heaven lies about us in our infancy. Though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. In the primal sympathy, which having been must ever be, in the soothing thoughts that spring out of human suffering, in the faith that looks through death, in years that bring the philosophic mind.
Thank you, Bev. That's a rather romantic view of childhood that Wordsworth captures. Since we are new to the, you follow this, since we're new to the world, we come trailing clouds of glory from the eternal whence we come, each like a newly formed star, and our maturing amounts to a gradual clouding over of that shining brightness that we were born with. It is true that infants do seem to behold the world in wonder, in heightened sensitivity, seeing splendor in grass and glory in flowers. A being fresh from the source of being, the child sees the world with a visionary gleam. The ways of this world have not yet imprinted themselves. The newborn is in the world, but not yet of the world. A blank and thus purer slate that has little or nothing written on it yet, and so has a cleaner perception. And we adults recollect and long for that infant state of being and sense of wonder. And that's what the poem says, which sounds great. Is there any truth in it? Well, there might be. Neuroscience has recently made some fascinating discoveries about the minds of newborns. As we grow, our brains become compartmentalized and begin to operate in independent networks which perform separate functions, you know, vision, movement, hearing, cognition, and so on. And so the mind is therefore more and more constrained by these bounded compartments. But the infant's mind, by contrast, is not constrained by compartmentalization, but is unified, free, unconstrained. Information floods into their open senses and mixes together in what's called synesthesia. Their senses mix, so they hear colors and taste sounds. So newborns can be thus hyper-emotional for, you know, who's more easily and overwhelmingly affected by sensations than a newborn. But the newborn can also be deeply at peace, for what is more soulful than an infant entranced by something? Newborns have no language, no names for objects outside themselves, and so they haven't made a self yet that's separated from the world. They experience the world as it is, not as we learn to think it is. So with no personality, no history, no self, the infant is all unrealized potential. Now, such a state of being as this, that involves synesthesia, the absence of ego, and a dreamlikeness, has often been framed as what used to be called the visionary or religious or mystical experience. So when we grow up, do we come to our senses or lose them? More than any other version of Jesus, as miracle worker, revolutionary sage, teacher, martyr, people have responded to this infancy. Because deep inside every one of us is the memory of our newborn experience, this default setting, the unified infant mind. And of course, we're not conscious of it. It's like a book we once read long ago and then mostly forgot, recalled only in echoes, calling us back to that state of infant wonder where heaven lies all about us. Is there any quick and easy way to recover that default, unified, newborn awareness? Prayer? No. Meditation? No. Good works? No. All you need to do is take 30 to 100 micrograms of lysergic acid diethylamide, that's LSD for short. Look, it's true. Neurological imaging shows that the mental state of an adult on LSD is almost identical to the mental state of a newborn infant. So it's official. Nothing that will ever happen to you in your life will be as trippy as being a newborn infant. Now, I'm not saying that all hallucinogenic drugs are good for you. Not at all. Some of them are great. But that's another talk. So the human mind's default mode The human mind's default mode we experienced in infancy is open and at one with the world and imaginatively alive to it. And it is still in us because, as Wordsworth says, what has been must ever be. But there is a further appeal to the nativity story beyond our recollection of innocent infancy and all its trippiness. The infant story is a radical vision of social utopia. It unifies the entire world. All classes of being are in this story. You've got everything from rich, wise kings to lowly commoners to beasts, all creatures, great and small. And the story brings together earth and heaven, too, in the form of angels, which are, of course, beings of pure spirit that can't normally be perceived, except on special occasions. Or maybe when you're tripping. Now, this infant's cosmic socialism, for that's what this is, was rather a shock to the culture that produced the story. This story was incredibly disruptive and subversive to the utopian prophecies of conventional Judaism. The Jewish prophets had foretold the coming of a Jewish leader that would unite the entire world and restore its right relationship to God in heaven. So naturally, they were expecting another King David, a warrior king, a strong man like a Pharaoh or a Caesar or Charlemagne or Napoleon or Hitler or Trump. A masculine adult leadership that would descend in power and might and reorder the world in triumphal righteousness by force. But what they got instead was this. A little bitty bunchy helpless baby. So what the story offers is the complete opposite of power. Because the human infant is the most powerless, the most unprovided for, the most vulnerable of all newborn creatures on earth. They're utterly helpless. They cannot feed themselves. They cannot warm themselves. They cannot avoid their own waste products. They cannot indeed move themselves at all. They can only writhe about like a larva. And all this sudden vulnerability and helplessness out of the womb responds to being newly in the world with seemingly incessant screaming. Wouldn't you? Now, to any impartial observer, these built-in vulnerabilities and inabilities cannot be design flaws, but design features. These aren't bugs in the game. This is a feature of the game. The human infant seems designed to suffer the world. Designed to suffer the world with all these vulnerabilities. But design alone doesn't define. Because in order to accomplish any of those most basic needs and survive the collision of their vulnerable little flesh with the inhospitable world, a child, by its very presence, has to mobilize and organize social relationships around it, usually the birth family at least, but also the extended or tribal family. So the infant survives only because there is a we around to care for it until it's self-sufficient. So the vulnerability and the helplessness of the newborn thus engenders a degree of social conscience and compassion, or else none of us would have survived infancy. So social relationship and compassion are human design features too, and they are the truest source of our species' survival, not our big brains. And they are the only sure path to our redemption as human beings. The infant, born powerless, born to suffer the world, is born to need others. And because what has been must ever be, we remember in the story of sweet baby Jesus our own vulnerability and need for loving nurture too. The tragedy is somehow we convince ourselves that we outgrow our vulnerability. We outgrow our need for loving nurture. That's our tragedy. Maybe this song will help. As you're able. So while very few of us have been a guru, a magician, a revolutionary, a shepherd, or a martyr, We have all been a dew-fresh, newly arrived infant, and we know what it is to need and to be nurtured by others. To need nurture and to be nurtured. We know that. Trailing clouds of glory from heaven, maybe not, but imbued with wonder, innocence, vulnerability, and a need for and response to care and nurture. And alive, of course, as children are, to the mind-blowing splendor of this created world. So why has the story of sweet baby Jesus persisted for so long? I think because it recalls in us what we have forgotten. Our free, unified child mind, our vulnerability, our dependency on others, that the only real life-giving power is loving kindness. And this alone will save us from ourselves. And you know, finally, that's it. That's the extent of our unconscious identification with this infant. Because although we've all been newborns, we know that this baby's story isn't fully our own story. The final reason this infant story persists, I think, is because we know more than these characters do. That's called dramatic irony, when you know more than the characters do. Everybody knows sweet baby Jesus is doomed. This baby story ends in an untimely and grisly surrender of his innocence to the power of church and state. So why does this knowledge help the story persist? Well, beyond the psychological hook of dramatic irony, where you've seen horror films where, you know, the viewer knows the murderer's behind the door and the characters don't. That's a powerful psychological hook. Beyond that hook, I think we want to believe that innocence does exist in us, can exist for us, in us, and in the world. We want to believe in the hope that this birth story continues to promise, with every telling, an imagined visionary world where kindness, peaceful being, and goodwill toward one and all is indeed possible, worth living for, worth creating and nurturing new life for, worth struggling for, even worth dying for. Now you might dismiss innocence, hope, and the visionary eye of the child as persistent human self-delusion, the darkness of our adult prison rather more reality than any clouds of glory we might trail. It kind of depends on you, how you regard your childhood and that of others. Maybe your experience with the sweet baby Jesus story, or with the ghosts of your particular Christmases past. It's hard to keep the newborn hope the story offers alive. I know my babies are grown now, and the bright promises of their births have given way to the compromised realities of their adulthood. But the image of the child, newborn, in squalor, and in a kind of glory, which has for two millennia resisted reinterpretation, resisted marginalization, resisted mediatization and eradication and cynicism and irrelevancy, and it's even resisted forgetting. That story offers you, even if you don't want it, a chance once in the rolling year to recover the visionary gleam you had when you first came into this world, when you were helpless yet cherished, and when you saw, however briefly, the world's unrealized possibilities afresh. So lift your gaze beyond the trite and the tawdry this year. Look up and see the love and the hope in those faces who gather around you. And beyond and above their smiling holiday faces, watch in the heavens the very same silent stars go by. Amen. Come Christmas and welcome. Come into the cluttered and unready manger of our hearts, that newborn life may stir in us and give mortal flesh to airy hope for healing for our world. Amen. And have a great week.
Well, we hope you enjoy this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.